Good afternoon, brothers and sisters, friends and young people. This afternoon, as our president has remarked, we will be dealing with the subject, should the cruel persecutions of the past be forgotten? And our structure of the address will follow something like this. We'll do a short introduction. We're going to revisit some of the remarks made by our speaker last week from the prophecies of Daniel, the writings of Paul in Thessalonians, and the book of Revelation. And this will form part as well of taking that view of history again and looking at the establishment of the Roman Catholic Church and how that led into that time known in history now as the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages. We'll be looking at just one example of the Inquisitions, the Spanish Inquisition being the Inquisition that lasted the longest period of time. And when we then focus on our subject, should the cruel persecutions of the past be forgotten, we will be raising the question, why should they be? Why should the cruel persecutions of the past be forgotten? What has changed? So just a quick reminder that this is the second in a four-part series. Our speaker last Sunday spoke on the origins of the papacy. We'll be dealing tonight with the cruel persecutions. Next week, God willing, we'll be looking at the doctrines of the papacy. And then the final part will be the downfall from a prophetical point of view of this great system. Perhaps we should start by asking the question, why are we bothered? Why are we concerned at looking at really what amounts to some gory details in history? And the simple answer to that is that Daniel, like the book of Revelation, is basically an unfolding historical book. And we are told in Daniel that it concerns things that shall come to pass. And it's those things that shall come to pass, many of them now fulfilled in history, but some of the prophecy of Daniel certainly has a future fulfillment, and that is why, really, Christadelphians are bothered about this subject today. Because our purpose is to show that the majority of mankind has been duped into believing a lie. And if they believe in a lie, then something else must be the truth, which we will endeavour to show. Well, our speaker last Sunday spoke of the metallic image. He also spoke from Daniel chapter 7 of the parallel prophecy, but instead of a metallic image being used in Daniel chapter 7, four beasts are used, two sets of symbols, basically, as our speaker brought out, pointing forward to the same events. If we remember, he said that Babylon, which was the empire over which Nebuchadnezzar ruled, was the head of gold and the lion as far as the beasts. The Medo-Persian from 542 to 334 BC was the breast and arms of silver and bear. The Grecian Empire, 334 BC to 67 BC, so just before the time of Christ, represented by the belly and thighs of brass and the leopard. And then Rome, the Empire or Kingdom of Rome, from 67 BC onwards. And we'll remember that our speaker remarked that whereas the Medo-Persian kingdom conquered the Babylonian kingdom, and likewise with the Grecian Empire, Rome was never totally overthrown. We'll come on to look at that in a bit. What I'd like now, just for a few moments, to turn our attention to is the time period involved in the subject under consideration. From the time of Daniel's prophecy, which was about 600 years before Christ, we are looking at a time of prophecy, of prophetical fulfillment from 600 years before Christ, even up to our day today. So we can certainly look back and see how some of these things were fulfilled. But what we'd like to have a look at is what the historians actually related the matters to, even in earlier times. And we are going to start looking at a historical perspective from AD 200. He says, Hippolytus saw that Nebuchadnezzar's dream from Daniel chapter 2 was a continuous unfolding of world history from 600 BC to the days in which he was living. Already, he said, the iron rules, that is Rome and the power of Rome, we see these things for ourselves. So this was obviously a time period of 800 years from the time of Daniel the prophet. And already this person could see that the power of Rome was developing. Irenaeus, just before this time, in a book called Against Heresies, wrote, "The apocalypse teaches us what the ten horns shall be which were seen by Daniel." And Origen, a little later, in Against Celsus, sees that the little horn of Daniel chapter 7, which we read in our introduction, and the man of sin represent the same power. An apostate system, is what he said. Some years later, John Wycliffe, in 1324, said, "Why is it necessary in unbelief to look for another Antichrist? In the seventh chapter of Daniel, Antichrist is forcefully described by a horn arising in the time of the fourth kingdom. For so, he says, our people see the Lord Pope." And William Tyndale, 100 years later or so, says, "The Bishop of Rome made a law of his own to rule his church by and put Christ's law out of the way. All the bishops must swear unto the Bishop of Rome they be the Antichrists and deny both the Father and the Son." Joseph Mead says the Christian common people called the Waldenses, the Albigensi, the Hussites, and by other names, began in divers places to renounce the authority of the beast, calling Rome apocalyptic Babylon and the Pope Antichrist, which being enraged, they tyrannized with fire and sword, but all in vain. And quite a popular person, Sir Isaac Newton, a well-known person, 1642, said, "A horn of the fourth beast was a kingdom of a different kind from the other ten kingdoms, having a life or soul peculiar to itself, with eyes and mouth. By its eyes it was a seer, and by its mouth, speaking great things and changing times and laws, it was a prophet as well as a king. And such a seer, a prophet and a king, is the Church of Rome." So, although we read from six or seven small quotations there, in summary we can see from these that it is clear that those historians or scientists aligned events occurring in their day with a continuous rolling out of the fulfillment of prophecy. They saw the Roman Catholic Church as Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, the great false prophet. So they aligned these prophecies with the Pope. So, just to remind ourselves, we said that our speaker last week spoke of this great metallic image, and basically what these predominantly relate to are the kingdoms of men. We remember that we had the head of image and lion representing the kingdom of Babylon, the breast and arms represented by the Medo-Persian Empire, the belly and thighs represented the Grecian Empire, with the leopard there, and the legs or iron represented this great, terrible beast. What we'd like to now do is just take a quick look at scriptural testimony which is recorded in a time period just over 600 years from the time of the prophet Daniel. And we're going to start with Matthew chapter 7. We certainly, young people and friends, brethren and sisters, don't have time to look at all of these, but we'll take just a few. Matthew chapter 7, verse 15. And this verse in context goes on from the words of Christ that the way which leadeth unto life is down that straight and narrow path. He continues, "Beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves." Acts 20 and verse 25. Acts 20 and verse 25, "And now behold, I know that ye all among whom I have gone preaching the kingdom of God shall see my face no more. Wherefore I take you to record this day that I am pure from the blood of all men, for I have not shunned to declare unto you all the counsel of God. Take heed therefore unto yourselves and to all the flock over the which the Holy Spirit hath made you overseers, to feed the ecclesia of God, which he hath purchased with his own blood. For I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. Also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away disciples after them." So this is very clear testimony relating to what was to come to pass after the time of the apostles. Now, in Daniel chapter 7, we said that we were introduced to the vision of the fourth beast, this time one which Daniel himself had. It was a vision that Daniel had. I'd like to go there to our introductory reading at chapter 7, Daniel 7 and verse 2. Daniel 7 and verse 2. "Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, the second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, the fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things." Now in verse 3 we are told that four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. These four beasts equate to the four diverse metals of Daniel 2, as we have already mentioned. The first beast in Daniel's vision was like a lion, which our speaker last week remarked represented the Chaldean empires of Assyria and Babylon. The next beast we are introduced to is the bear, which had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, an illustration of the bear's great appetite for conquest. And this exactly is what the Medo-Persian Empire had, this answer to the arms and breast of silver. The leopard then is the next dominion, and history shows she was a symbol of Greece, being an agile and swift animal, showing that the empire would be taken in a swift manner, and history shows that Alexander the Great conquered the empire precisely in that way. This dominion or empire was overtaken by an unnamed beast, described as dreadful, terrible, and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth, and it devoured and brake in pieces. And this equates to the iron legs of the image and represents the Empire of Rome. The Roman armies devoured the Grecian Empire and literally break it in pieces. Daniel saw this fearful beast on a rampage, extending its conquests, swallowing up territory after territory. In BC 168, Macedonia was swallowed up, followed by Syria in BC 65, followed by Egypt in BC 30. The territory was ruled by emperors which extended from Rome. The beast had 10 horns, which again symbolized the divided state of the empire. All of these empires that I have spoken of were military powers. But then Daniel is introduced in his vision to an 11th horn, which was little and was growing among them. At first, the 11th was little in comparison to the 10, but it grew to be the dominant one. It was unique, too, in that it was fitted with eyes and mouth, and these identify it as an ecclesiastical or horn pertaining to religion. It represented the rise of the Roman Catholic system that aspired to great power and influence, but it was little because, unlike the military might, which conquered nations in a moment, the little horn took centuries to grow to power. Daniel chapter 7, verse 16. I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. These great beasts which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld in the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed against them. We will develop in a moment how this 11th horn found its development in the 4th century with Constantine, the so-called first Christian empire. But these 2 chapters of Daniel are extremely important prophecies, and they have come to pass in precise harmony with the details here foretold. The reason we have chosen to introduce our remarks in this way is because we can show precisely how the prophet depicted a time when the Church of Rome would become a worldwide dominating power, whilst at the same time being with a prophet who tells us that the Roman Catholic Church would have an end and be smashed into pieces in the same way as the kingdoms of men will be smashed to pieces in the latter days, that time in the earth when God shall pour out his judgments to cause the inhabitants of the earth to learn righteousness and to learn of his ways. What we now wish to do, very briefly, is look again at the development of Christianity and show how a great departure from that apostolic Christian faith was predicted. Because when we start to talk about the development of Christianity, what we are really talking about are those things relating directly to the Lord Jesus Christ, his character, his faith, and his beliefs. And the scriptures are absolutely clear on this subject, and they tell us that the only people who can truly say they are Christ's friends are those who follow his commandments. Any departure from the beliefs he held or any departure from the things he practiced is a departure from apostolic Christianity. What is very important to realize is that the scriptures prophesied a great departure from this Christian position, as we have seen from Acts and the Gospel according to Matthew. And what's more, that departure was to commence even in the first century amongst them. Many in the last couple of hundred years might accept that inevitably there would be a falling away in our times, 2,000 years on from the time of Christ. But very few people pay any attention to the detail comprehensively set forth in the Word of God that foretold that even in Christ's own day there would be those in sheep's clothing who inwardly were mere wolves. Human nature has always been the same. It naturally rejects truth and accepts error. As our brother mentioned last Sunday, we're going to make some very critical references to the Roman Catholic Church in the time that we have remaining. And we wish to point out that we are exposing them for what they are as a system, not just for the sake of criticizing or putting down other religions. We have a strong desire in the next 20 minutes or so to expose that wolf in sheep's clothing in harmony with the prophetic writing to show that that system is not all that it is cracked up to be on the surface. Come with me quickly to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Verse 1. Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and by our gathering together unto him, that ye be not soon shaken in mind, or be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter as from us, as that the day of the Lord is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Remember ye not that when I was yet with you I told you these things? And now ye know what withholdeth that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now letteth or hindereth will hinder until he be taken out of the way. And then shall that wicked one be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all the power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. Here then, Paul tells us of this man of sin, which we will endeavour to show is the Pope. In the early centuries, something was preventing that full development of what became false Christianity, and that prevention was paganism. The worship of Mars and Jupiter and all the other pagan objects of worship throughout the then Roman world actually prevented the development of the spread of false Christianity. It's interesting to bear in mind that no universal kingdom or empire was to appear after the Roman Empire in the image that stood before the king. Historically, we have said that the Roman Empire was established around 60 years before the time of Christ and was therefore to extend in a broken form to the setting up of the kingdom of God. Yes, it was to become divided, but it was not to be overthrown in the same way as Babylon, Medo-Persian, and the Grecian empires. It is reasonable to expect from the prophecy of Daniel for the 11th horn to spring up during that 2,060-year period, and history shows that the might of the papacy was actually established by virtue of the military might of Constantine as one of the first Christian emperors. We see in his day the development of a combined role one as having a great influence over religious reform and also being the emperor of the empire. We see this development in its entire fulfillment some 500 years later in the Emperor Charlemagne, who established the Holy Roman Empire. The power of Rome and its influence over the development of false Christianity can be seen throughout history, and we shall see that the temporal power of the Pope remained a tremendous power for a considerable period in the centuries that followed Christ almost to our day. We were going to cover just some of that history again, but time is running away with us, so I think maybe we'll skip most of this. And conclude just in that historical part with this quotation from Charlemagne, who became the head of the Holy Roman Empire in around AD 800. Perhaps Charlemagne's most lasting contribution to European society was his idea that a king should rule over both the state and the church. Charlemagne saw it as his right and duty to administer divine law over all Christians and to maintain authority over the workings of the church. This conception of rulership had not been seen in Europe since the fall of the Western Roman Empire. Charlemagne sowed the seeds for a power struggle between these two institutions, which would last throughout the Middle Ages or Dark Ages. And we've quoted that because it is an important development in history because of Charlemagne's objectives, which was to rule religion and state. Come with me to Daniel chapter 7. Verse 25. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High. Bearing in mind that this is this little 11th horn, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. We don't have time this afternoon to show specifically what those 1260, to prove, if you like, that the times there relate to 1260 years. But the prophecy described bitter persecution for this period of time. And if we take the date 608, we learn that Emperor Phocas issued a decree and pronounced the Pope as head of all the churches. Thus the popes were given temporal power, and this lasted 1260 years to the time of the French Revolution. And interestingly enough, this was the development of the mouth of the little horn. It was during those years especially that the saints or witnesses were persecuted, that they were worn out, as we've just read in Daniel 7:25. 1260 years later, in 1868 to 1870, the last remnant of temporal power was taken from Pope Pius when the revolutionaries under Garibaldi finally occupied Rome and made it the capital of a united Italy. At first, the papacy opposed him militarily, but in AD 1870, war broke out between Prussia and France, and the French troops had to be withdrawn. The papal forces were thus defeated and Rome fell. The papacy no longer retained the power to militarily or diplomatically intervene in the international affairs of state. The Pope, lacking temporal power, withdrew into the Vatican, where he became, as he styled himself, the prisoner of the Vatican. And so the prophecy of Daniel speaks of the time when the truth and true believers holding fast to the one faith and one gospel which they had been wisely counseled to keep would endure a time of terrible persecution, bitter persecution, and history once again provides some of the details of that for our attention. When the prophet Daniel saw the vision of the believers of God being persecuted in this way, couched in those words of the prophecy, "And he shall wear out the saints," it is recorded, "As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me. But I kept the matter in my heart." Revelation 17. The persecution was to be so bitter that it changed Daniel's constitution. It troubled him. Revelation 17 and verse 4. "And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colour, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration." Yes, Daniel was troubled to know that for a period spanning more than a millennium, his fellow believers would endure severe persecution. And not only troubled by it, his whole countenance was changed as a result of the experience. And here John, in the Apocalypse, sees a similar vision of blood emanating from the witnesses to the truth. And when we look back at those dark ages, we can see why. That period makes us shudder to contemplate. And if we were able to see it in vision so graphically and so vividly as Daniel, surely we would be troubled, and our countenance would certainly be changed. We should be immensely thankful that in our day we are generally not slaves to tyranny. It was that period of tyranny which helped the wrong doctrines of evolution spread like wildfire some centuries later. So then, as we said in our introductory remarks, we wish to take the Spanish Inquisition as the one that we would use for our purposes of showing just how the witnesses were subject to such terrible suffering. The Spanish Inquisition began in 1478. As we say, it was a specific time period. It lasted until 1834. Inquisitions themselves began, I think it was in 1248. The Spanish Inquisition is known for the terror it caused the inhabitants of the Iberian Peninsula. Although the Inquisition originally began to purify the nation from heretics, it came to have more materialistic, racial, and political motives instead of just purification. The beginning of the Inquisition is generally credited to the reign of Ferdinand V and Isabella. In truth, it began before that time and carried on long after Ferdinand and Isabella passed away. In order to better understand the Inquisition and the reasons behind it, it is necessary first to examine the events that led up to it. The Jewish people are often associated with wealth and with being a plague to the society to which they belong. 14th century Spain was no different. In the city of Seville, there was an archdeacon named Martinez who continually tried to incite the people to purge themselves of the dirty Jewish citizens. After several reproaches by the Spanish cardinal and the Pope, Martinez finally succeeded. On March the 15th, 1391, Martinez incited his congregation to riot. The crowd moved en masse towards the Juderia, the Jewish quarter. Some of the participants were captured by the police and flogged or beaten, but that was not enough to stop the mob. Although they did not succeed that day to destroy the Jews, the feelings that Martinez had evoked lay simmering until June the 6th, when the mob sacked the Juderia of Seville. It is believed that the victims numbered in the hundreds, if not thousands. After that episode and a few sporadic others, the Jews thought themselves to be free of those problems. but this was not to be the case. When Ferdinand V and Isabella were married, it united Aragon and Castile, the two most powerful states in Spain. At the time, Spain was on the verge of becoming one of the wealthiest nations of the period. A large part of that was due to the Jewish community. After their ordeal with Martinez, many Jews had professed to believe in Christianity to free themselves from persecution. It is doubtful, however, that many of the conversos, as they were to become known, were truly converted to the Christian faith. However, these conversos came to enrich and perhaps dominate almost every aspect of Spanish society. The problem was that the Jews were getting all of the things the non-Jewish Catholic people wanted. The Jews were able to gain wealth and positions of power and authority in the kingdom as new Christians. The Catholics, however, could not do anything to them because these new Christians were at least in profession Christian. The hierarchy of the Spanish Church became concerned with the reports of heresy of some of its new members. And then in 1478, the time came that the true Christians had been waiting for. A young cavalier who was trying to court a Jewish girl went to meet the girl and came upon a group of Jews and conversos in some mysterious celebration. That night was the Jewish Passover, and the assembled had come together to celebrate it. The problem was further exacerbated because that week was also the Holy Week for the Catholic Church. News spread quickly of the blasphemy that had been done. A few months later, at the urging of the heads of the Spanish Church, Pope Sixtus issued a papal bull giving authority for an inquisition. However, the authorization was actually given to the Spanish crown. They were to be the ones who would appoint the bishops to complete the inquisition. Thus, the Spanish Inquisition was founded to purify the nation from heretics. Although purification was the original intent for the Inquisition, it came to have more materialistic, racial, and political motives, which led to the terror for which it is now infamous. The Spanish Inquisition was executed at the request of Isabella. She was a very pious and devout Catholic. One of her advisers, who would later become the first general inquisitor, was Thomas. A rumour exists that while advising the Queen in her youth, Thomas had her to take a vow that should she ever reach the throne, she would devote herself to the termination of heresy and to the persecution of the Jews, which at the time seemed unlikely. Now, however, she was in a position to do what she had vowed to do. Besides, the Queen had already said she wanted one country, one ruler, and one faith. The Catholic sovereigns were determined to have a united country, and they did not believe this ambition could be achieved unless all other subjects accepted one religion. This they were determined to bring about through persuasion, if possible, and if not, by force. Spain, under Isabella and Ferdinand, was ripe for the Inquisition. That was why the cruel institution was embraced so heartily and continued to survive until the 19th century. It is likely that Isabella truly wanted to end heresy within the Catholic faith. Ferdinand, however, was not as pious as his wife and probably saw the opportunity for wealth. It is highly likely that some of Spain's early triumphs abroad and at home were financed through the Spanish Inquisition. This idea of financing without increasing taxes could be seen as Machiavellian in nature. Machiavelli suggested that in order for a ruler to hold his principality, he must not overburden his people with taxes, yet he must not spend all of his funds either, or he would risk not being able to finance the maintenance of his kingdom. It is not likely, however, that Machiavelli would have been pleased with the attitude that the Catholic kings had produced in their subjects. The Spanish Inquisition was particularly terrifying because of its inherent characteristics. The accused never knew who their accusers were. Once arrested, the accused heretics' properties were seized. These properties were then administered at first by the crown and later by the general inquisitor. This fostered the means for anyone to accuse for personal reasons or to get gain. In many areas, men began to wonder whether a man's worldly wealth, as well as his descent, was now become an incriminating circumstance. The Inquisition certainly did not limit itself to purifying only those of the Jewish faith. This was especially true if the accused was found to have any Jewish blood in his ancestry. Even if the accused was now a devout Christian, he was tried as severely as possible because of his roots. The accused was not allowed to have a lawyer or counsel for his defence, and the names of all witnesses were kept secret from him. The punishments and tortures used to gain confessions are the most famous parts of these inquisitions. Because the trials were for spiritual matters, the church handled them. However, the punishments were usually very much physical, so they were handled by the state. There were many means of this physical torture for confession. The two most famous or infamous were the strappado or pulley and the ocelli or water torment. The strappado was a device that used ropes to strap a person in by their arms and legs, and then weights would attach to the ends of these ropes. The person was raised to a certain level, and then the ropes were released. This created a situation where the body would be stretched, painfully, sometimes enough to produce death in itself. The ocelli was accomplished as a person was brought to lay down on a trestle with sharp-edged rungs and secured with an iron band. Their feet would be elevated above their heads. The accused then had a small piece of linen forced into the gullet. Using a jar, water would be poured into the mouth and nose, producing a state of semi-suffocation. The process would be done repeatedly. While doing that process, the cords binding the limbs would be tightened until it would seem the very veins would explode. The torture would not be stopped, but a break could be taken. The difference is that if the torture was stopped, it could not be started again according to church law. But if the torture was only suspended, it could be resumed at a later time. The tortures were used on old and young alike to get confessions and to learn of accomplices. In this way, the Spanish tried to ensure they would be pure. Once a confession was reached, if it was heinous enough, the perpetrator would be sentenced to death. The sentence of death was carried out as the accused was thrown into a fire as an auto de fa, act of faith. The fire was reserved for those who would not admit their heresy, those who relapsed in their heresies, and to other dissenters. The guilty were burned because the church believed they, that is the church, should not be a direct party in the shedding of blood. To remain free of blood, the church relaxed or handed over the guilty to the secular arm. Once handed over, the church would recommend mercy, with a qualifier that if the accused was guilty, they be punished by death. It was understood that the secular authorities would immediately condemn those with relaxed status to death. If the guilty were fortunate enough to die in the prisons instead, they and their families were still not safe. Their dead bodies, along with effigies of those that had escaped to other lands, would be taken along with the living and thrown into the fire. This allowed the lands of all those people to be confiscated, if that had not already been done. There truly was no escape from the fanaticism of this Inquisition. It has been suggested that this was an ethnic as well as religious purification. The difference between the Spanish Inquisition and the Papal Inquisitions was that the Spanish Inquisition was turned over to secular authorities. The secular authorities were the ones who were in charge of the maintenance and perpetuation of the Inquisition. From the actions of the Spanish Inquisition, in conclusion of this part, it is apparent it was an ethnic cleansing. The Spanish Inquisition and its actions caused 200,000 loyal but Jewish Spaniards to leave the country. Surely the Spanish Inquisition was about more than just religious purity? The crown gained in many ways due to the Spanish Inquisition. Ferdinand and later monarchs were able to use the guilty as rowers for their warships. Also, besides increasing in wealth because of the Inquisition, the Spanish crown gained a certain amount of control over the Catholic Church in Spain. Because Pope Sixtus gave the authority to the crown, the Catholic Church lost some authority and control of Spain. In summary, the Inquisition in Spain began in 1478 and officially ended in 1808. During that time, 323,362 people were burned, and 17,659 were burned in effigy. It is one of the darkest periods in Spanish history. By far the greatest number of cases tried were for Judaizing. These were also the cases that were tried the most severely. the Inquisition definitely had racial overtones, although it can be said that Queen Isabella officially initiated the Spanish Inquisition for the purity of faith, nation, and people. The materialistic desires of the aristocracy certainly factor into the reasons for the perpetuation of the Inquisition. Indeed, it was the darkest period of history. So the question is, should these persecutions of the past be forgotten? If the Pope today was given back temporal power, would he be any less harsh than they were a couple of hundred years ago? Have the instruments of torture been decommissioned, or are they still around in the world today? Has the Mother Church really changed its policy on these matters? And have the oaths of their Jesuit priests changed to reflect a less harsh position? We can certainly tell you that the Jesuit oath is the same today as it was in the 1400s. I'd like just quickly, I realise the time is just about to go, but I'd like just quickly to read from a couple of internet forum entries on the church justifying its position. And it was written in May 2000. The first entry is, I have read with increasing horror the recent posts condoning the burning of heretics at the stake. It seems that the conservative branch of the church feels that the Crusades, the Inquisitions, were completely justified. The church is never wrong, and if you ever question what went on in those years, I suppose you are branded a what? A heretic? I do know in my historical studies that without a doubt there were many corrupt practices taking place in the church, and that some of the so-called heretics were really just good people trying to make some changes. He goes on to say, I cannot believe that anyone who professes to be a Christian would ever condone the torture and burning of heretics. He says, I am losing my faith in the church if this is the case. Heretics are revolutionaries against the church, comes an answer from Dr. Warren Carroll. Heretics are revolutionaries against the church, and if they are given a free hand, can and will imperil the salvation of millions and begin the upheaval of society. Ask anyone who knew the communist revolution in Russia or Cuba what horrors revolution brings. So even as late as 2002, the church in reality was still subscribing to the events of its history. I think, in conclusion, we'll go back to Daniel chapter 7. We will cut our remarks short. Daniel chapter 2, I'm sorry, not Daniel chapter 7. So from the outset, we said that there were to be four universal kingdoms. So Babylon, Medo-Persian, Greece, and Roman. And that in the prophecy, there was then to be a fifth universal kingdom. Verse 34 of chapter 2. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet, that would of iron and clay, and break them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain, and filled the whole earth. Verse 44. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand for ever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So what we see in the second chapter of Daniel, in this prophecy, is the kingdom of Rome remaining right up to the time when Jesus Christ will be revealed in the earth to establish the kingdom. And in the same way as all of the other kingdoms were taken by conquest, with the exception of Rome, as we said earlier, and so this kingdom that God is shortly to establish in the earth shall also overthrow. And in this time, will overthrow the entire system of the kingdoms of men. And in its place shall set up a universal empire that shall never be destroyed. Daniel chapter 7, we read in verse 25, that for those 1260 years, he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand, until a time and times and the dividing of time. But the judgment shall sit, verse 26, and they shall take away his dominion, to consume and to destroy it unto the end. So, even from Daniel's prophecy we can see that that time of persecution after 1260 years was to come to an end. But the judgment shall sit, they shall take away his dominion, to consume and to destroy it unto the end, and the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So, in conclusion, we submit to everyone here tonight that we should never forget the persecutions that happened for such a long period in the time of history, those dark ages from 1248 to the early 1800s, because those cruel persecutions were actually executed by a system that still exists today. And if that system that still exists today had the opportunity to re-establish its power, it would do so, and it would purify the earth in exactly the same way, in bitter persecution for all those centuries. But we are pleased to say that the prophecy of Daniel tells us very clearly that that time is to come to an end, and in its place there shall be that fifth universal empire which Jesus Christ shall reign over, the righteous king. When, if we turn to Psalm 72, which is our last quotation for this afternoon, we see a much brighter picture. Verse 1, give the king thy judgments, O God, and thy righteousness unto the king's son. He shall judge thy people with righteousness, and thy poor with judgment. The mountain shall bring peace to the people, and the little hills by righteousness. He shall judge the poor of the people. He shall save the children of the needy, and shall break in pieces the oppressor. They shall fear thee as long as the sun and moon endure, throughout all generations. He shall come down like rain upon the mown grass, as showers that water the earth. In his days shall the righteous flourish, and abundance of peace, so long as the moon endure. So how will Jesus the Christ bring about what is talked about in verse 7? In his days shall the righteous flourish, and abundance of peace, so long as the moon endureth. He will do it subsequent to the words of Psalm chapter 2. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the nations for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them, talking about the nations, the heathen, thou shalt break the nations with a rod of iron, thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Be wise now, therefore, O ye kings, be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and ye perish from the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in him.